We're discussing federal grand jury indictments of a Wisconsin strip club owner and manager and what it means for this industry and the work to root out human sex trafficking. Please be aware, this is a sensitive conversation on The Morning Show. Please take care. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, a federal grand jury charged Radomir Buzdum, formerly of Watertown, and Timothy Miller of Watertown for offenses in how they ran TNT Strip Club, which was located in Dodge County. And according to the indictment, they tried to drive up revenue by operating an unlawful prostitution business. Do you live near a strip club? What is law enforcement doing to ensure illegal activities are not taking place? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me on, Kate.
Well, fill us in more on this case and the federal charges against these men.
Well, so this is just the latest string of charges against Wisconsin strip club owners and operators. We've seen quite a few in recent years. In this case, Radomir and his manager of both of TNT Strip Club in Lebanon were accused of essentially profiting, especially on their champagne rooms and VIP rooms. They did some renovations where they did things like installing locks, set up cameras in a way that wouldn't record what was going on in the room. Changes that federal prosecutors say were essentially to help them profit from sex trafficking at their club. They're accused also of working with sex traffickers, of what's commonly known as pimps, helping them either operate out of the strip clubs, allowing them to control women who were working in the strip clubs, who were also working for these men. Often these women said they were sex trafficking victims, that they were being abused and coerced and forced into prostitution by especially one pimp who was involved at TNT, who's also been, he's been charged and also convicted.
Yeah, you know, the status conference revealed that the case is based on information gained during the prosecution of Christopher Childs, who was found guilty of sex trafficking at this strip club. Has, like, one case led to the next?
I think in a lot of these cases they have, where one, you kind of, it's kind of like dominoes falling, where there's one case and then that leads to an investigation, or they find things in, and that leads to charges for other individuals. So Christopher Childs, the court documents really portrayed him as a sex trafficker who was frequently threatening, abusive, and violent towards women. Some really gruesome things in some of those court documents. I won't get into some of the details, but it really sounds like he was, according to the documents, quite brutal with some of the women working for him. He has been convicted, but in the case against him, there were quite a few things that were concerning about the strip clubs where he was operating, and that essentially that he kind of worked with strip club owners and operators to control women. They would report back on the dancers' behavior to Childs. Some of the allegations were that he was just allowed to essentially operate there, free drinks, treated like a VIP. I think some of the allegations were that, like, they carried bags for women who worked for him, things like that, where it was almost like he just had free reign of some of these clubs.
You know, the government has a lot of information here. The status conference had some numbers that was given to the lawyers. The government has about 30,000 pages of discovery data from 18 devices, 23,000 pages of materials produced by the IRS, 93 witnesses. What do you make of the volume of evidence in the Buzdum case?
So I think one interesting thing is that supposedly, from what I had read in the Childs case, that a woman came forward. She was identified as victim number one in the court documents because they didn't want to release her name. She talked about being coerced into and being trafficked by Childs. as part of that case, they started gathering things like Facebook messages, social media, phone calls, texts. And then that led to they found communications with others and they connect. So it's, I think a lot of these cases, they kind of connect the dots and one charge could lead to other investigations and other charges. And I think that's what we're seeing here. And so I think some of the volume of the documents that they have is related to they kind of pull one thread and see what comes loose in other cases.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mary Spicuzza, who's an investigative reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's been long reporting on cases involving human sex trafficking. And this federal grand jury indictment, the latest here in, of a strip club owner and manager in Wisconsin. Mary, how is this case and others like it linked to the levels of sex trafficking happening in Wisconsin?
You know, I think sex trafficking is a really underreported crime for a number of reasons. Often these women are some of these women aren't even women, they're girls, they're minors, often very coerced, abused, and kind of recruited because they might be in a vulnerable situation already. And then often they might be too scared to report or think that this sex trafficker is actually looking out for them or, you know, that they're almost like family. And so we really, I think we only have really kind of know the tip of the iceberg of the extent of sex trafficking and human trafficking in Wisconsin and around the country. So it's hard to know exactly how much, like how many numbers we're talking about with victims because it's so underreported. But I do think it speaks, I think cases like this speak to the fact that this is not, Milwaukee is often talked about as a, heightened problems with sex trafficking, human trafficking. I think this case reveals, and we, as you know, a lot of prosecutors have talked about, it's not just Milwaukee, it's not just cities, it's a lot of rural areas and really stretches through, suburbs, rural areas throughout Wisconsin. And often these networks of traffickers will traffic women away from their homes. So it might be someone who's from Milwaukee, but who's then taken elsewhere to either other cities or rural areas to be trafficked.
And when you mentioned tip of the iceberg, I'm wondering this business model that Buzdom had in, being charged with operating an unlawful prostitution business, what might be going on at other strip clubs in the state?
That's a good question. I know there are strip club owners who say that they're trying to root out sex trafficking at their clubs and that they wouldn't have anything to do with that. I think that there are a lot of questions about what goes on in especially things like champagne rooms or VIP rooms. I think it's long been known and long been a problem that strip clubs have been linked to sex trafficking rings. So I think it would be helpful if some of the patrons who go to strip clubs, they may mistakenly think that sex trafficking is a victimless crime and that they're just having a fun boys' night or boys' night on the town. And I think it's important to realize that, if people didn't patronize sex traffickers, they would be out of business and demand helps fuel their profits. So I think especially for women who are or girls who are underage, who the term child prostitute is really, I think, a term that should be probably retired in favor of sex trafficking victim because minors cannot consent to have sex. I think that thinking of women that they're not all there just of their own free will, to be aware of things like that might help kind of change attitudes about sex trafficking victims
and, Mary,
and what might be some of these clubs.
And Mary, very quickly, what are you watching for in the federal charges in the Radmir Buzdom case and Timothy Miller?
I think we'll certainly be looking for what comes out of this case, if it leads to charges for other strip club owners. A lot of these clubs, this one was very much owned by by Radomir and operated, but a lot of other clubs are owned by LLCs rather than individuals. And this one was actually owned by an LLC, but largely controlled by him. But so you don't necessarily know who all the owners are of an LLC or who owns a strip club. And so I think we'll be trying to keep an eye on if this does lead to charges or investigations at other clubs and who are the people behind those LLCs. And, you know, what's in those documents in terms of how places operate, how these kind of places operate, and how they profit from sex trafficking.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up, we talk with a Milwaukee-based advocate and survivor working to stop the cycle of human sex trafficking and to support victims. What efforts can you talk about in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're looking at how to end human sex trafficking and provide support to victims. Please note this is a sensitive conversation. Please take care. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of human trafficking convictions each year has steadily gone up over time. That's from the 2020 Federal Human Trafficking Report out this month. It stated last year federal courts convicted the lowest number of defendants in human trafficking cases since 2012, and the vast majority of criminal cases involve female victims, women and girls. Do you know someone at risk of becoming a victim? What are the circumstances? How are you working on this issue in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. Nancy Yarborough Banks is founder and executive director of the Milwaukee-based Fresh Start Learning, Inc., advocating for victims of human trafficking. Nancy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nancy, there are these preconceived ideas you've heard so many times over that human trafficking only happens with people in poverty, only happens somewhere else, or it's a snatch and grab type scenario. Can you dissect these myths and explain the reality of human sex trafficking?
You know what? Absolutely. I mean, there is a common misconception when you don't know something, and where we say ignorance is bliss. And in this case, it really is, only because we know that the average age being 13, which we know is reported, but the average means there is some above and some below of young ladies and young men being pulled and lured into exploitation. That means wherever there's a child, there's vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So that means anywhere. I've worked with young ladies now upward of 10 years, and I've seen them from the suburbs, from the rural area, from Indian tribes, from Hmong community. It hasn't had one caveat like most people would think. A black girl issue in the inner city with a single mom must be on drugs. You know, that is not the scenario at all. It's the curiosity that lies in the heart of everyone and the vulnerabilities that lies in the heart of every child and the need to feel loved and accepted. Now, the next thing that I found out was more of the curiosity that pulls anybody in because I want to see, I want to know. You know, and the way that they're streaming now trafficking is more appealing to our youth than ever before.
How do you see traffickers using the internet as a tool to lure victims?
Well, you know, there's all kind of apps, even some of the apps that we might not think that are used for this particular pull in or draw in or grooming process. Something as simple as Christian Mingle, which we have Instagram, a Finstagram, which is a fake Instagram. There's so many different ways. Our children are more apt, or anyone that has a heart of vulnerability that may have been in a domestic situation or trying to make ends meet. Those kind of CEO kind of pimps, which means more business oriented, use the internet quite a bit because there's an opportunity for photo shoot, an opportunity for massage parlor, an opportunity for escort servicing, you know, an opportunity to show up as, an extra in a room for a video. You know, all these things are very appealing to our youth. And because the world in its streams of influence causes our youth to believe that it is okay between music and videos and things that we watch on primetime TV, it's almost impossible for our youth not to think things that are sexually and high in sexual content is okay.
I want to talk about your organization here, stepping in, providing a space for victims, and you call it Humble Beginnings Drop-In Spot. What do victims need when they come to you?
You know what? Because I was a young lady and that my vulnerabilities pulled me away into the life of exploitation, I just thought about all the things that I may have wanted to make it feel more like an adjustment from that life to the next life. So when they first come in, we offer brand new pajamas, fuzzy socks, a hot shower, something to eat, you know, just so that you know once you walk into those doors, everything else behind you is now closed. There's no pressure. There's no pushing, no prodding. I realize that when people are open and feel safe and comfortable, they'll have more of a fluid conversation. So for us, it's making sure that we're meeting them where they are using harm reduction and then matching them with a program for a longer term support and care is essential. It's not just getting them a place to stay. It's what is the biggest barrier? Is it mental health issues because of the trauma? Is it drug addiction first? Is it legal issues to get your children back? There's all kind of layers, but we let them be a part of it. And that's the most important thing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nancy Yarborough Banks, who founded Fresh Start Learning, Inc. Her nonprofit gives a voice and support to people who fall prey to sex trafficking. Nancy, what are your conversations like with people you are helping? Is there a way you can describe with sensitivity what they have experienced?
Absolutely. Again, coming from a personal standpoint and then coming from a professional standpoint, I love the fact that God has allowed me to have both conversations when it was me and now when I'm on the outside. So I'm very sensitive to being a big ear, right? I'm just want to listen first, you know, and then interject when I'm asked. The main thing that I've learned, if somebody is talking about their trauma, what they've been through, there's no time for you to say, oh, well, he was no good for you. She was no good for you. She meant you no well, even though our heart knows that. It's up to us to understand they have not allowed themselves to detach from that love interest that they thought that was there for them, that took them in when nobody else wouldn't. All the manipulation and the mind games that are played in exploitation. We have to remember, if that person trusts you enough to start talking, the best thing you can do is listen. And when they ask you, then start answering to the best of your ability using your I statements. And remember that you're talking about human nature. So as soon as you start trying to tear down a wall that you didn't help build, it's going to be really, really reluctant to have that person trust you any further because they've already been used to the games.
One of the things that you do is help connect victims to legal support, legal services. And, you know, we've been looking at these cases and about sex trafficking in the courts. And I'm wondering what strikes you about these strip club cases and whether there is any action.
I think that sometimes it's the hardest thing to come against something that's already established. If a person believes this is a legal entity, it has the doors and the ability to have the doors open and people patronize the place. When you start talking against something that people say, well, they had a choice. They could have said no, they didn't have to do it. They could have told someone, you know, all those things come into play. And for that, a lot of the victims are scared to speak up, you know, to say that I was violated in the way that I shouldn't have been violated. I ask myself a lot of times, once you find the younger girls inside of these strip clubs like I was, why didn't you card me? Fake IDs are very real, but you can look and tell this child is just a child, you know, and I think that once our police system and the legal systems come together as an opportunity to say, let me look back on this child's history to see if there's been petty theft for lingerie and all those kind of things. I think when they do the restore and rescue, they'll have more of an opportunity to build a case against those strip clubs and other places that take advantage of the vulnerable.
When you talk about restore and rescue, how could law enforcement do this work differently and not put blame on the victims?
Education. I've had the pleasure of doing a lot of awareness and prevention campaigns through our legal systems, and even our hotel chains. Everybody that has a part in this needs to have education based on their role in this particular person's life once they become in contact with them. The training cannot be cookie cutter because it's not going to be the same way. The officer's job is to protect and serve, and he's given or she's given a manual on how to handle different situations. But in that manual, do they have dealing with a vulnerable youth that may be very aggressive because they've already been told the police is not your friend, don't trust them, don't believe them, they're against us, to let them know it's not about that. Look at that person and realize the first thing, what are they doing here?
So much to discuss. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Nancy Yarbrough Banks, Executive Director of Fresh Start Learning, Inc. You can find help at the National Human Trafficking Hotline, 888-373-7888. News is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin's tourism industry lost almost $4 billion in 2020 compared to the previous year, as many families put off travel because of the pandemic. In Wisconsin Dells, there are already signs that this year's tourism season is going to make up that deficit, and then some. Rob Menser has more.
It's early in the summer tourism season in Wisconsin Dells, and it is already sweltering. At a water park at the Wilderness Resort, kids are waiting in line for their turn at the water slides. Grandmothers are floating on the lazy river. Jada Walton spent the last year in virtual school. She's enjoying this trip with her aunt, uncle, and cousin.
It feels good. It feels nice to finally be back to kind of sort of normal.
Jada's uncle, Thomas Billups, lives in suburban Chicago. He says after more than a year of staying home, being back out in public is an adjustment.
It doesn't feel natural just yet, but, you know, I'm just kind of working my way into it slowly. But, yeah, it still doesn't feel natural.
There are a lot of people who didn't travel last year due to COVID-19, but who now are newly vaccinated and ready to make use of their new freedom. Bookings are up in tourist spots across northern Wisconsin, and managers at Wisconsin Dells Big Resorts are expecting a massive tourism season, maybe a record-breaking one.
It is going to be a good year. We can tell looking at reservations that we have for June, July, and August compared to 2019. At the same time, that we're already significantly ahead by 12 to 13% compared to 2019.
Joe Eck is the chief operating officer at the Wilderness. It's a sprawling 600-acre resort with more than 1,100 employees and 6,000 guests on an average summer weekend. Last year, all Wisconsin Dells resorts closed abruptly in March during the COVID-19 shutdown. When they reopened just over a year ago, they didn't know what would happen.
We're in the business of tourism and, service, and to not have as many people as you had in years past, it put a scare in a lot of people, and a lot of people, I'm sure, wondered if their business model would succeed. Is it going to be the same one year from now?
Across Wisconsin, the tourism industry took a 30% hit in 2020. In Wisconsin Dells, the decline was about half that. But it was a hard season, with more friction than usual between visitors and workers, between workers and employers. People were on edge about the pandemic, or their business, or both. There were some businesses that didn't make it. But today, those look like the exception in Wisconsin Dells, not the rule.
How are we doing?
Of course, there are new challenges. On a golf cart ride across the resort, Eck points out the dorms that, in a typical summer, would house 400 exchange students brought to the U.S. as guest workers. Right now, they have 110 student workers. They're hoping that rises to about 200 this month. Fewer students are being approved for travel because foreign embassies are still closed due to the pandemic. In the absence of guest workers, employers are having to increase incentives for domestic ones and cross-train their workers to fill in the gaps. John Chasten is general manager of the Kalahari Resort.
There hasn't been minimum wage jobs in the Dells for years. Our average hourly wage is up quite a bit, which comes from us increasing the wages of our current employees, hiring at higher wages. And so we're just at a different place than we were even in 2019.
Rising wages are good for workers. They're also translating into higher prices for visitors to the Dells. So far, that's not stopping people from coming. Despite the full parks, though, things aren't totally back to normal yet. Chasten says about half of the Kalahari's business comes from conventions. Those mostly haven't returned. They expect that side of their business won't be back to normal until 2022. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now to the college sports world and the battle over whether student athletes should be compensated. Is the NCAA model of amateurism about to collapse? In recent years, multiple states have passed laws allowing student athletes to cash in on endorsements. Eyes are on Florida, with its law taking effect July 1st. Wisconsin is one of 13 states without any bills in the works. That's tracking from governing. What are your thoughts about college student athletes getting paid endorsement deals like the pros? 800-642-1234. Nellie Drew is a professor of sports law at the University of Buffalo, where she directs the Center for the Advancement of Sport. Nellie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Historically, college student athletes could only accept scholarships, no endorsements, no salaries. But, you know, sports is billions of dollars, college sports. You know, why was this model of amateurism set up in the first place?
Well, historically, it goes back a very, very long time. When the NCAA, which was initially known as the International Collegiate Athletic Association, was formed in 1905, we didn't have, you know, social media, we didn't have cable television, and the revenues weren't part of the equation. Over the course of time, as the revenues have expanded exponentially, as revenues have appeared to have been become a driving force in collegiate athletics, the pressure has built for that, you know, that windfall, if you want to call it that, to be shared with the student athletes who generate it.
You know, there are states all over the country that have legislation in the works involving student athletes. What is the NCAA going to do about this?
That's a great question. And why they haven't acted before now, I really can't tell you. There has been pressure recently. President Mark Emmert of the NCAA was appearing before Congress this past week, requesting federal help. But it seems like a little late in the game to be doing that.
You know, this issue has gone all the way to the Supreme Court. The justices have a case testing whether the NCAA's limits on compensation for student athletes violate our antitrust laws. Give us some contours of this case, because the players are arguing that college sports is a business.
Yeah, so there's really no question that it certainly is. Although the NCAA has historically hung its hat on the idea that, you know, they produce something that is unique. The amateurism model, it's different. It's separate and apart from, say, the NFL, and that should justify certain lenient treatment, particularly under the antitrust laws. And historically, most of the courts, including the Supreme Court, have bought into this model. But that's harder and harder to defend now. And the case that you're referring to, the Alston case, is quite honestly a frontal attack upon the NCAA's restrictions upon limits on compensation to student athletes that are in non-cash form. Things like, you know, assistance for computers or scientific equipment, musical instruments even, that sort of thing.
What do you make of student athletes really struggling with food insecurity and homelessness and these reports that this is very widespread?
That's a problem. And, you know, it's hard to identify exactly how widespread that problem might be, but the fact that it occurs at all is just unconscionable. And, you know, it's important to recognize that not every single athletic department makes money. According to recent reports from about 2018, there are only 23 or 24 athletic departments across the United States that reportedly actually show a profit. Now, that's deceiving, because money gets plowed back into that same department, right? So you have coaches' salaries, you have, you know, very nice video game rooms, you have all kinds of things, you know, luxuries that go with certain brands. But having said that, it's heartbreaking to see that some student athletes are struggling. And there's actually a Disney Channel movie about one young man who took in his 11-year-old brother as a student athlete because his mother was suffering from some abuse issues. And he was unable to accept rides or meals from the coaches or their wives because it was forbidden under NCAA rules.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Nellie Drew, who is a sports law professor at the University of Buffalo, where she focuses on sports law, discipline of professional athletes, player contract negotiations. We're looking at the fight over compensation and whether college athletes should be compensated. Your thoughts at 800-642-1234. So, Nellie, California's Fair Pay to Play Act, that passed in 2019, the first state-level law to create opportunities for student-athletes to be compensated. How has that gone over?
Well, that was the tipping point, really. That was the first law passed, and although the effective date is not until 2023, that galvanized other states. So what we saw in close succession after that, we saw Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, New Mexico jump on board. Those are the ones that are going live as of July 1st. And it was interesting to note that it was shortly after that, the NCAA initially pushed back and then recognized we have a problem here. And then that's when they first started to recognize that they needed to do something to reform the name, image, and likeness rules as they currently stand, because it wasn't going to work.
All right. Name, image, and likeness rules. Can you explain what that is, how it works?
Sure. So name, image, and likeness refers to a student athlete's ability to capitalize upon their own personal brand. Historically, any attempt to do that would have been seen as a violation of the rule against compensation. The whole point of the NCAA is supposed to be that you're an amateur, not a professional, and that you are not entitled to receive any sort of pay for your ability to perform as an athlete, whether that's directly or indirectly. So that was the basis for this. But it's a very antiquated system. And again, you know, the optics are really bad when you have student athletes, many of whom are, you know, people of color, some of whom may well be from underprivileged communities, working very hard, spending all kinds of time, not in a position to earn compensation any other way because of the amount of time commitment that they are having to devote to their sport. And then, you know, you have the programs which are generating immense amounts of revenue, not sharing those with the student athletes.
Let's bring in a call now. Philip is joining us from Nina. Hi, Philip. What are your thoughts on athlete compensation?
My thought is that amateurism and college sports, at least in the big ones like football and basketball, hasn't really existed in the large conferences like the Big Ten for at least a couple decades now. They work the athletes like they're, you know, like actually workers, but they don't pay them like they are. They have worked long weeks, probably longer than I work, just prepping for games every Saturday. So.
And so I think, Philip, that you would lean toward compensating these athletes in some way. Oh, I think we lost Philip. But, you know, he's saying here that these are athletes who work very long hours, Nellie.
Yeah, that's a great point. And in fact, what really sort of started this whole, you know, train going down the tracks was a case at Northwestern that you may recall from some years ago, where the Northwestern football team decided that they wanted to try to unionize. Now, it's kind of funny. The moral of the story here is you have to feed young male student athletes well, or they get very unhappy. Essentially, what it seemed to be the problem was that they were not getting good food at Northwestern. And then on top of everything else, made them very unhappy. And they decided to try to unionize under the National Labor Relations Act. Ultimately, their effort was unsuccessful, but the process galvanized the student athlete community, and it brought attention to the fact that almost every aspect of their lives was very tightly controlled by the athletic department. And you know, Northwestern's a great school; the football program is you know, fine, but it's not, you know, LSU. And the extent to which these people were being, you know, these young men were being dictated in terms of everything that they did, and the amount of time commitment, as your caller indicated, was extensive, something along the lines of 80 hours a week during the preseason, which when you try to put that together with a full-time collegiate, you know, learning schedule.
How are you supposed to go, get your classes in at the same time, a full class load? That doesn't seem possible.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, I've got a little bit of a war story. I'm a hockey mom, and my daughter was recruited as a goalie. And at one point we attended a recruiting visit at a D1 institution. And she was informed that when they scheduled their practices, she would be blocked out by the registrar from registering for courses that would conflict with the practice schedule. Yeah. And I looked at her and she looked at me and was like, honey, you know what? This is not what you're doing for your career. And that was the end of that institution for us.
Wow. University of Buffalo sports law professor Nellie Drew explaining where things stand for student athletes in the fight for compensation. Should Wisconsin allow college athletes to sign endorsement deals with shoe companies or car makers? What impact do you think allowing college athletes to get paid and sign endorsement deals would have on recruiting programs? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nellie Drew on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about compensating student athletes as state legislation around the country could open the door for athletes to get deals beyond their scholarships. Former NFL quarterback Joe Theismann weighed in on Fox Business recently, asking the question, who do you pay?
You're going to start bidding and buying, you know, young kids. And I just think it's a mess if they try and do this.
Would this be across the board for all athletes or just some? Should there be caps and limitations on how much they earn? Join in 800-642-1234. Sports law professor Nellie Drew is with us for about nine more minutes. Let's bring in John now in Milwaukee. Hi, John. What are your thoughts?
Hi. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the NCAA is considering right now, going to a 12-team playoff system. With a conference champion from each six conferences and then six at-large bids. That's going to extend the season to anywhere from like 15 to 17 games now for these kids. And it makes, I think, even a better case for them being compensated in some way. I just wondered if you could talk about that a little bit. And I'm going to go off here because I have a kind of a bad connection.
John, are you referring to football?
Yes, football.
Yeah. Nellie, what about extending the season?
Well, I think your caller makes a great point. To the extent that you're requiring student athletes to dedicate even more time in the season to their sport, it certainly makes it more difficult to focus upon academics. And, you know, again, you know, things have changed. It used to be that, you know, you played your sport in the off season, you know, you do what you did. And now it's year round. Preparation and you know, coaching and the like goes on all year. It's a tremendous commitment. And so that's, you know, one of the best arguments that I can think of, that student athletes should be treated with, you know, more consideration and given the opportunity to, you know, generate some revenue from their efforts.
But I think there's also this criticism, as we just heard from Theismann, like, where do you draw the line? Is this Division I, Division III? What about women? What about men? I mean, how do you structure this?
Oh, okay. That's a great question. It's going to be a mess, quite honestly. And I put that right back in the NCAA's lap. This has been coming down the tracks for a very, very long time. And I've been sitting there watching it saying, why aren't they doing something? I can't give you a good answer for that. They didn't even attempt to start addressing it until April 2020 when they formed a working group to develop a group of proposals for how to restructure the name, image, and likeness rules. That working group delivered proposals last November 2020. That is way too late. And then they neglected to vote on it in January. They're still waiting, supposedly later this month when they meet, they're going to be voting on it. But again, this is way too little too late.
You know, Wisconsin doesn't have a law in the books yet allowing college student athletes to monetize their, you know, celebrity status with endorsements. But UW announced it has partnered with Open Doors to kind of create a name, image, likeness readiness program. Can you explain where Open Doors comes in?
Yes. So there are various third-party platforms that have been organizing over the course of the last couple of years, and we've seen this movement gain momentum. And the idea is that these third parties would provide some sort of structure, some sort of support to both schools and student athletes to help ensure compliance with whatever rules are developed, to provide some assistance to student athletes, as I'm sure you can appreciate the fact you've got 17, 18-year-old young people who have perhaps little business sense entering this world where there will be tax consequences, the potential for fraud, you know, all kinds of things. And the idea is these third-party platforms would provide them with the ability to engage with potential endorsers with some sort of security and guidance.
So as, you know, at the state level with a patchwork compensation, you know, legislation and programs, what does this mean for recruiting athletes to these colleges?
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting, that's for sure. As of July 1st, we're going to have, you know, five states going live with the name, image, and likeness ability to generate revenue. So those would be Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and New Mexico. And as of July 23rd, Arizona will enter that mix as well. So if you are a coach of a high revenue sport in one of those states, you're going to have a decided advantage over other coaches, presumably.
Mm. We're talking with Nellie Drew, sports law professor at the University of Buffalo, as we look at compensating student athletes and what impact it would make across the spectrum of NCAA sports. Your thoughts as well, your questions, 800-642-1234. So these changes affecting college-age athletes now, could there be a trickle-down effect to younger athletes, like at the high school level?
Yes, I would anticipate that would happen. And I'm not entirely sure that's a bad thing. When you think about it, historically, we've had 17, 18-year-old student athletes signing, you know, scholarship deals that have vast financial implications, particularly for, think, people who are might be drafted by Major League Baseball or the NHL. They have significant financial consequences without the benefit of counsel. You're not supposed to have an agent. That's one of the rules that the NCAA has put in place to try to preserve its amateurism model. And it's really not a fair transaction under those circumstances. So I'm not opposed to the idea of having high school athletes having access to responsible counsel.
How much more lucrative might this be for student athletes as you watch these five states go live? What might happen for the athletes?
So that's a good question. I mean, it's a very individual situation, right? Mm-hmm. And we've actually seen situations where significant others of student athletes or of athletes have been able to raise their profile by, you know, using their positions as influencers. Here in Buffalo, New York, we have a player in Buffalo Bills, Jordan Poyer, and his wife, Rachel Bush, is a very strong influencer on social media because of her position, you know, and that's not unheard of. What we've seen as sort of an example is that in cheerleading, which is not an NCAA regulated sport, some young people have been very successful in positioning themselves to make money. There's one young lady named Shannon Woolsey out of Texas Tech. She appeared in the Netflix documentary Cheer, you may be familiar with, and she was getting $5,000 a post. And she's been able to use an agent to maximize her brand, again, because she does not fall within the NCAA regulations. There's another young lady in high school who's been getting $2,000 a post. That's a pretty good chunk of money for somebody in college, right? Or high school.
Yeah. So what are you watching for here as this unfolds at, you know, NCAA, unfolds in the Supreme Court and at the federal level, state level?
I'm going to have a very different syllabus next year, I can tell you that. Kate, I'm not entirely sure what to tell you, except that it's going to be different. And it's an opportunity for change. The one thing we haven't mentioned is the fact that at the federal level, Senator Cory Booker, who is himself a former D1 athlete at Stanford, has taken this opportunity to push for a student athlete bill of rights. Now, this is a concept that has been squashed by the NCAA previously a couple of times, but I think it's important to consider. And the idea is to take this opening to ensure that student athletes receive health coverage and the opportunity to finish their education for an indefinite period of time. Now, the financial consequences of that could be significant, so it's going to require some rethinking. But given the pool of money that March Madness alone generates, I would think it's entirely possible to construct something that would be of benefit to all student athletes.
Nellie, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Kate.
Nellie Drew is a sports law professor at the University of Buffalo. She directs the Center for the Advancement of Sport. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.